This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Warning. The following podcast, which contains strong language and mature content, is unsuitable for children or for the faint of heart. The subject matter discussed will be frightening and graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Three spooked girls.
When you want to hear about the paranormal, you get the spooked girls, true crime that makes you hypothermal, with the three spooked girls. Stabby snippets will give you dreams. Tara and Jessica will make you ask, along with the spooked girls. Bring on the slaughter. We on that haunted ground.
Spooked girls.
The three spooked girls.
Hey, spooksters, and welcome back to another episode here on Three Spooked Girls. My name is Tara, and as always, I'm here with my girlfriend, Jessica.
Hello.
Hello. And today, as you can see, we are continuing on our series on the murders of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. We're at part, I don't even know what number this is. Six, maybe? I'm not sure. so much OJ has been consuming our life.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into all of the stuff Jess has for us today, if you are new here, hello, welcome. Thank you for checking out the show. Returning spooksters, welcome back. If you would like to hang out with us on social media, we are on Facebook, Instagram. Our Twitter is still there, but I don't know. I saw some article saying like, you gotta pay now or something. But if you want to find us there.
Gross.
I have no idea. We are at Three Spooked Girls, or we have our Facebook group, which is Three Spooked Girls Official. We do book club, gift exchanges right now. Secret Satan is fully underway. Jessica got everybody paired up, all sent out. So hopefully we're seeing some cool stuff. But yeah.
The most stressful weekend of my life.
There's a reason we only do like one or two exchanges a year.
I was like, oh my God. I was like hyperventilating. Like I kept telling Tara, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh God, I can't. And she's like, you got this. I was like, I don't. But I made it through. Me and the cats.
So yes. So go to our Facebook group. We also have the link tree in the show notes that has everything pertaining to us. Jess and I are also on Instagram and Threads. You can check out our stuff in the link tree as well. And if you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/threespookedgirls. For as little as a dollar, you get one bonus episode a month. Five and up, you get ad-free episodes. And it's usually a day early. So that's pretty cool. I don't know. But you can check out everything over there. Oh, and also we are some of our other tiers too. Like our highest tier, we gave free access to those patrons just as an extra little thank you. So there's all kinds of stuff that just kind of like pops in for you guys over there on Patreon.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. But with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Jessica and we're just going to get going back to this trial, guys.
I just want to say, guys, I have done more research on OJ Simpson than I have done on any other human being in my entire fucking life.
Wow.
And I hope you're here for it.
Yeah.
If you are like me and you're wanting to consume more about this case, because this case is really fucking fascinating from a like perspective of watching blunders happen in a courtroom, mm-hmm. definitely check out the book, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson by Jeffrey Toobin. It's where I got a lot of my stuff from, and I'm actually going to be referencing several times, as Tara can see.
Mm-hmm. All the notes.
I have flags.
Yes.
All the flags.
All the stickies.
Where I'm like, I'm just not going to copy them into my notes. I'm just going to read from the book.
There you go. It's like book club. I love this.
It is. It's really well written. It's Jeffrey Toobin is an attorney turned journalist. Mm-hmm. So it's a really great perspective because he does have that like cultural authority over this particular like subject matter. Mm-hmm. And he was there for a lot of it.
Right.
So let's get right on in. So Tara handled the prosecution and I'm handling the defense. I'm going to go back and forth some on some things because like there's some things that made more sense to do within the defense team than it did with the prosecution. Mm-hmm. So at this point, we're going to talk about assembling the dream team. And I am not talking about the basketball team in the 90s.
Oh.
With Michael Jordan and all those fun people. I know. Just heartbreaking. This is the O.J. Simpson dream team.
Gotcha.
So if you remember, right after he gets the phone call, he calls a lawyer and he calls Skip Taft, which is his like attorney. And he's like, okay, you need a criminal attorney, like a criminal attorney, a criminal defense attorney. So he calls Howard Weitzman. Howard Weitzman lets him go and get interviewed by the police without him there and just requests tapes, which is the dumbest shit I've ever heard from a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Kardashian. Bobby and Skip are like, you have to get a new attorney. You have to get an actual good criminal attorney. You need someone who can handle this case because it's going to be fucking huge. And so at the time in LA, the biggest celebrity attorney or fix-it man was a man by the name of Robert Shapiro, played by John Travolta.
I was waiting.
If you're wondering. Ironically, in my life, I know several Robert Shapiros, none of which are this man.
No.
Mm-mm. Who I believe died in 2020. But I'm going to read you the introduction from his wiki page, because when I read it, I was like, okay, the world needs to know this. Oh, God.
Okay.
Robert Leslie Shapiro was born September 2nd, 1942, and is an American attorney and entrepreneur. He is best known for being a short-term defense lawyer of Eric Menendez in 1990 and the member of the dream team of O.J. Simpson's attorneys that successfully defended him from charges of the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ron Goldman in 1994. He later turned to civil work and co-founded, are you ready for this, Tara?
Oh my God, yeah.
ShoeDazzle.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, ShoeDazzle, LegalZoom, and RightCounsel.com, appearing on their television commercials.
Whoa, what the fuck?
So I own several shoes from ShoeDazzle.
Yeah, I used to, yeah. Oh my God.
I have paid this man money, apparently.
Shame, shame. Mm-hmm.
Robert, or Bob Shapiro, attended UCLA for his undergrad and get a BS in finance. And he would attend Loyola Law School and graduate with his JD in 1968. In the case of Lyle and Eric Menendez, who murdered their parents in 1989, we know this because, like, mm-hmm. you know, we've done it before.
Yeah.
Basically, if you remember, Eric had gone back into his tennis career. He had gone to Israel for some time. And when they were like arraigning them,
mm-hmm.
he was there and I wouldn't come back. I'd be like, fuck you guys. But basically, Robert Shapiro was the one who brokered the deal to get him to come back for his arraignment.
Mm.
Bob was also known as the plea bargain attorney. So if you needed, like if you did it, and you needed someone just to get you the fuck out of it with like a lesser time, Bob Shapiro was the man to call.
Yep.
He was not well versed as a trial lawyer, but that meant he needed to reach out to another person. And that was going to be F. Lee Bailey. The two had been friends for like a decade plus. Bob had represented Lee, which is his preferred name, when he'd gotten into trouble with a DUI in February of 1982 in San Francisco. Bob Shapiro was his attorney. So they obviously trust each other because I think it's a big deal if you're a lawyer to trust another lawyer.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
For most of the 1970s and the 1980s, F. Lee Bailey, or Lee, was known as the best defense attorney in the nation. He had a laundry list of clients. Are you ready for these?
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm. Sam Shepard, who would later inspire the TV show The Fugitive. He was convicted of killing his wife, and Bailey took the case all the way to the Supreme Court and basically got a retrial and then won.
Oh.
He also represented and won with the Boston Strangler case, Adam DeSalvo. He basically got him off on all of the murders, just got him off. He just had to like serve time on the assault charges.
Oh My God. What?
Right? One of his most famous clients was one Miss Patty Hearst. If you don't know who Patty Hearst is, she's the newspaper heiress who basically committed armed bank robberies with the Sabanese Liberation Army, the SLA. And this would be the one that he loses. Just saying. Still, yeah. It's a pretty big deal. Oh, just fun facts for you on this. Just like he lost it in his closing statement. He seemed disjointed is what they said, quote unquote. Basically, people thought he had been drinking.
Oh.
According to the book that I read, Jeff by Jeff Toobin or whatever his name is, Ethel Bailey was a bit of an alcoholic. It was his
It
was his theme. He ended up spilling water on his pants during his closing statement. But don't worry about Patty, because she only served 22 months of her 12-year sentence. And she was commuted in 1977 by President Jimmy Carter. And then she was pardoned later in 2001 by one Mr. Bill Clinton. Also, Lee at the time, one of the reasons is they brought Lee in is if you watch the docuseries or the drama series, Simpson takes a polygraph test that Shapiro and Kardashian have him take and he fails it. They didn't really understand it. And when Lee graduated from college, he basically just like went in and learned as much about polygraph tests as he could. And he became like the standard of like people you would have in your life. Nope, that's wrong. I'm sorry. That's Alan Dershowitz. My bad. But Lee was like understood this. I apologize. That was later in my notes. He was an expert, though, in polygraph tests. Also, really fun thing is that Lee and Shapiro would have some bitch fights during this.
Oh.
So basically... when your first call is like, I would think like if I'm a defense attorney and my first call is my most important call, right? Like he calls Lee like right away. Well, come to find out when Shapiro signed a contract with Simpson, he basically said that Simpson wouldn't have to pay Bailey, that if any charges were incurred, it would be Shapiro's like responsibility. But Shapiro was like in this whole thing and he's just a little bitch. You'll find out a lot in this era of life. He basically is like on a vacation and he calls Lee and they're talking and Bob tells Lee, oh, you're doing this for free. You're a volunteer and do not fuck with F. Lee Bailey. That man will fuck you the fuck over. And he did. Yeah. He literally was the person who went into like, he was on Larry King and he was like, you know, people say this about Robert Shapiro. If you watch the drama series, he's like, then why the fuck are you saying it? Like, it's that.
Yeah.
He was just very good at his way of like stirring up discord.
Mm-hmm.
Another member of the team, which I'm only noting because of the proximity to myself, is Robert Blazer. Blazer was a student of Alan Dershowitz, who we'll talk about in a minute. And he just like was like a helper. But fun fact, he practices in the greater Sacramento area.
Oh, wow.
He practices in Folsom, California, which is like 20 minutes from my house.
Oh, shit.
The next is going to be Sean Chapman Holly. According to her Wikipedia page, Holly graduated from the University of Los Angeles with a BA in English in 1984 and went on to the Southwest University Law School and got her law degree in 1988. She would become a public defender where she would work with Johnny Cochran. And then when he opened the Cochran firm, she would go with him over there and she would be part of the dream team. She would later go on to open or like be a part of her own law firm. And I was texting Tara about this. She has had in her lifetime, some big ass.
Yeah.
So here is a list, according to the Wikipedia page, of her clients. She has had one Miss Kim Kardashian, Tupac Shakur, Snoop Dogg, Paris Hilton, Nicole Richie, Lindsay Lohan, and one Mr. very gross, very recent, Danny Masterson. I literally was like texting Tara. I was like, one of his lawyers represented Danny Masterson. And Tara was just like, this is so gross.
So gross.
It's so incestuous.
Yeah.
The next person is Alan Dershowitz. Alan is a former law professor. He taught U.S. constitutional law and American criminal law at Harvard. It was said in the book and on the show that basically he would drop that he taught at Harvard as much as possible. He was a name dropper. He joined them in 1964. 1994 as an associate professor. He had barely graduated. He was like 28.
Oh, wow.
When he became a full like professor, and because he like joined as like an assistant professor in 1980 or 1964. But by 1967, he had become a full one, which he was 28 years old.
Damn.
He was the youngest professor in the history of the law school.
I believe it.
He's very smart. Very, very smart. After the O.J. Simpson trial, Allen would go on to have even bigger clients who are just as equally pieces of shit. Freya came to say hi. Freya, let's tell them. Jeffrey Epstein was his client in 2008.
Bro. I was dying when she was telling me this.
I was like, oh my God. He was a member of the legal team when they first brought charges against him. And it was the investigation where he was accused of repeatedly soliciting sex from minors. He also, I'm going to mispronounce his last name, is Julian Assange, who is the WikiLeaks guy. Was also one of his. I'm not really, like, I don't really give a shit about the WikiLeaks guy.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, he was the dude. Okay, so the WikiLeaks guy basically, like, leaked a bunch of, like, classified documents on a website called WikiLeaks.
Oh, okay.
It was, like, a big deal.
Gotcha.
In, like, 2011. We were too preoccupied with, like, William and Kate getting married.
Yeah, I was like, that, yeah.
He has two more really interesting people that he represented. One, Mr. Harvey Weinstein.
Jesus,
all the bad assholes, like the dick faces of the world. He didn't win this case. A lot of these cases he didn't win, which I'm like, cool. And then his most recent big one in 2020 is he represented Donald J. Trump. He represented him in his first impeachment. The next one is Barry Schick. Barry Schick is a law professor at Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York City, and he is a forensic expert. He is going to be the one on this team who's going to come in and basically like walk the defense and basically cross-examine all of the evidence that they end up doing. The next one is Peter Newfield. I think that's how we're saying his name. He basically was an assistant. He was an assistant and he was coming in to undermine the DNA evidence as well. So he worked with Schick on that. Carl E. Douglas was one of Johnny Cochran's top lawyers. And so he came with him. I believe he is the one, if you watch the drama series, where he's like the one who puts in the wrong information. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about the big one. One Mr. Legendary Johnny Cochran himself. Johnny Cochran was originally from Shreveport, Louisiana, and his parents moved to California in 1949 in part of what is called the Second Great Migration, and they settled in LA. He got a bachelor's degree in economics from UCLA. Remember how Shapiro got like a bachelor's in finance?
Mm-hmm.
So that's very similar. He also went to Loyola Law School, but he graduated several years earlier in 1962. Whoa. So I think that's very interesting that they basically were like samesies. In 1963, Johnny took a position as a deputy city attorney in the criminal division. And if you watch The Incredible or The Marvelous Miss Maisel on Amazon Prime, you might recognize the name. His first big case was one Mr. Lenny Bruce, who was a comedian, who had gotten in trouble for saying some shit on stage. And that's who Johnny had to fight again, or had to like prosecute.
Gotcha.
So I was like, ooh, this is all entwined.
It is.
He would only be with the city attorney's office for very short. He would open his own practice, which would be Cochran's, Atkins, and Evans. But that would only last a few years as well, because then he went back and joined the LA DA's office as the first district first assistant DA. He wanted to help the DA's office become known as the good guys. But Johnny doesn't sit still very long, because 5 years later, he left and he opened Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Law Firm, or the Cochran Law Firm. He was very outspoken against the LAPD, especially in 1992 with the Rodney King riots. And he was kind of the voice of the Black community in the media. He was a commentator on many news organizations, and he was very, very highly respected. Mm-hmm. I want that to be known as well. He may have been like kind of a showman. People described him as being able to speak like a preacher, but he basically had a really, he had a gift in taking something really complicated like the law and making people understand.
Mm-hmm.
Not always for good, because he joined the O.J. Simpson defense team, let's be honest here. But like, yeah, I know the whole time I was doing the research on the defense, I was like, fuck them. I hate them all. they helped a man go free. We're going to talk about jury selection because that was the one part we missed before. But yeah, the defense, Bob Shapiro and Johnny Cochran, knew that the attention that OJ was receiving was eventually going to wear off. And so they needed to pounce on this. And they pressed for a speedy trial. And I don't remember if we introduced him last time, but we're going to learn about Lance Ito, Judge Lance Ito. He is a judge. So they told Judge Ito, we want to go on with jury selection. And it started on September 20th, 1994. Tara, today is September 20th.
When we're recording this.
Just 29 years later.
Yes.
Before that, each side had to prepare for jury selection. And this was very important for the trial. And I think this is one way the prosecution lost this case. Mm-hmm. The defense hired a very well sought after jury consultant, Joanne Demetris, and she worked on the Rodney King cases. She's worked on some big ones, and she understood the assignment of picking a downtown jury. She would come to every single day of jury selection and make notes, and the defense team would listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
However, the DA's office, the prosecution, run by one Miss Marcia Clark, was not as fortunate because Marcia Clark's ego got in the fucking way.
Mm-hmm.
The DA's office wanted it to be in a downtown, so they kept it there. And DA Gil Garcetti announced that this would be a non-death penalty case and would steer the prosecution in a good direction. Basically, if it was a death penalty case, you have to identify as a juror whether you would be willing to be on there. You would be called a death qualified juror. So this actually would make it easier for the prosecution, but they didn't. They made it harder for themselves. So then Gil, having this friend by the name of Donald Vinson, he hires him because he, in 1989, opened what's called Decision Quest. Basically, Donald was a professor of obscure marketing, and he came up with this idea around jury selection. We see it as very common practice now, where people do a lot of investigation into putting together the right jurors
mm-hmm.
and the right demographics for cases. However, this wasn't that big of a thing. And so he started his company in 1989 with like him and a buddy and maybe a couple other people. But by 1994, he had over 200 employees. That's how good he was.
Wow.
Marcia Clark was having none of the shit. She, in her mind, had it one way. So when Donald was like, let's set up a mock trial, Marcia was like, fuck this shit. No, thank you. I don't want to do this. And she was convinced, because she had tried so many cases in front of Black women, that those were her people. Those are her words. That those are her demographic. That's her people. She spoke to them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, she had a little fan club of Black women who had been jurors who constantly wrote her over the years. And so in Marcia's mind, because this one small subset of Black women found her smart and intelligent and doing good work, all Black women were going to. And she was also convinced that Black women especially would sympathize and understand Nicole's situation regarding the domestic violence. These were her statements. Like, this was her big crux of this. She could not have been more wrong. They didn't want to do it in LA because they wanted a different like pool of people. So they basically were flying to Phoenix. However, as they're leaving LAX, fucking Marcia Clark forgot that she had a gun on her. So this whole big shit happens.
Oh my God.
Where like she has to like get pulled over by TSA because she has a gun. And granted, this is 1994. So this isn't as crazy as like now if you had a gun, but like still it was a big fucking deal. And when this happened, the TSA agents tipped off. They tipped off reporters. All these reporters knew it. So Marcia Clark was like, fuck this shit. I don't want to do this anymore. We should just cancel. And Donald was like, well, you flew all the way out here. We should do something. She's like, well, I don't want to do the mock trial, because she didn't want to do the mock trial anyway. And this was her way out. So he's like, okay, we have these people. Let's just ask them questions. So basically they asked them to rate each person on a scale of 1 to 10, people involved in the case. When it came to Nicole Brown Simpson, she received scores of 7, 5, and 3. She's the fucking victim.
Yeah.
When it came to OJ Simpson, he received 9s and 10s. When they were asked to give their impression of the lawyers, Robert Shapiro, who, you know, is head counsel for the defense at this point in time, was called smart and clever and charming. And Marcia Clark was not given such nice descriptions. In fact, she was considered, this is the words they used for her, it was shifty, strident, bitch. In fact, they used bitch a lot. And Marcia is literally like sitting in another room watching this on like a CCTV situation.
Yeah.
Literally like black women are like, no. They're like, she's a no for us. Mm-hmm. And Marcia's like, I know exactly what I'm talking about. Girl, you did not. And according to I'm going to read this excerpt from the run of his life. It's on page 193. According to the telephone poll, black men were 3 times more likely than black women to believe that Simpson was guilty. Moreover, black women felt overwhelmingly that even if Simpson had engaged in a pattern of domestic violence against his ex-wife, that didn't make him more likely to have killed her. According to the telephone poll, a full 40% of black women felt that the use of physical force was appropriate in a marriage. And black women especially could not stand Marcia Clark. No, it says abide, but I wanted to say stand. So Donald gives all this information to the DA's office, to Marcia Clark, and she's just like, fuck no. Another one of my favorite things is they called her a castrating bitch because they saw a symbol, O.J. Simpson as a symbol of black virility in a predominantly white world. You guys should see Tara's face right now. It's just like, oh, gotcha. No.
Yeah.
So Judge Ito wanted a really large jury pool. In fact, he had 900 jurors, potential jurors, come in throughout this process. And this was a breakdown of that jury. This is from the book. The initial group provided a fair approximate of the overall jury pool in the downtown Los Angeles area. They were roughly equal in men and women, 28.1% African-American, 37.9% Caucasian, with the remainder divided up between Latinos, Asians, and others. Overall, the downtown jury pool is about 31% African-American and 30% Caucasian. So those were pretty even. Because this was going to be a sequestered jury and the LA County only pays you $5 a day for your jury service. So think about that. Like there was literally 9 months of being paid $5 a day.
Ugh.
This was going to be a big deal. They were literally going to live in a hotel. They did not have TVs in their room. They couldn't go to the pool. All of their like reading materials had to be pre-screened. All of their movies and stuff had to be pre-screened. Nothing could have any mention of OJ in it. People would listen in on their phone calls to their family so that their families couldn't give them information. The sure. only time mm-hmm. that information could slip through, which was a privacy issue, was during conjugal visits. Jurors got conjugal visits.
I mean, people have needs.
People have needs. Oh, and the other thing is at 9 o'clock at night that the deputies would come around and collect all of their cards, their room keys.
Oh.
Because they didn't want jurors to leave their room and go to other people's rooms to hook up. On day one of jury selection, 219 jurors reported. Of that, Judge Ito excused 90. He was like, if you want the fuck out, get the fuck out. Interestingly enough, when they called the first juror number, it was number 32, which was O.J. Simpson's number, his career number. So oh, wow. Judge Ito was like, oh my God, this is crazy. 9 days after they began, they had whittled it down from 900, like over 900 to 304 willing jurors who understood what was going to be asked of them. Then the jurors were put through a very intense questionnaire. Now, typically questionnaires aren't that long and they really are about conflict of interest. But Ito was like, you know what? I'm going to let the defense attorneys just have their way with this shit. And he did. So we have some questions like, where were you born? Where was your spouse born? We also have you ever had a personal interaction with a celebrity such as Willie, or writing a celebrity a letter, receiving a letter or autograph from a celebrity, or getting an autograph from a celebrity? Yes, no. If yes, explain. That was one of the questions. Some of these were like essay questions. They'd like provide 3 lines and expect you to. Do you have any affiliation with professional sports? How do you feel about interracial marriage? Do you have a religious affiliation or preference? Yes, no. If yes, please describe. How important would you say religion is in your life? There's all of these types of questions. Do you have, and it says, please check security bars, arms, guard dog, weapons for protection. How many hours a week do you watch sporting activities? Are you a fan of USC Trojan football? What is your favorite sports team? Do you belong to like AA, Sierra Club, the NRA? I mean, this one makes sense. Have you ever seen a crime being committed? They did ask, have you ever been in a domestic violence case? Those kind of questions make sense. They would ask like personality type questions. Like, do you seek out positions of leadership? Always, often, seldom, never. Please name three public figures you admire most. So yeah. And this would be the breakdown of the jurors. Of the 24 jurors, there were 15 African-American, 6 white, 3 Hispanics in a county that had just 11% black. Over the months to come, 10 jurors would be replaced by alternates. Based on their answers of their questionnaire, 12 of the jurors who ultimately decided the O.J. Simpson case had the following characteristics. All 12 were Democrats. 2 were college graduates. Not one juror read the newspaper regularly. 9 lived in rented homes. 3 owned homes. 2 had supervisory or management responsibilities at work. 10 did not. 8 regularly watched television, tabloid news shows like Hard Copy. 5 said that they or a family member had personally endured a negative experience with law enforcement. 5 thought it was unacceptable to use force on a family member. 9, 3/4 of the jury thought O.J. Simpson was less likely to murder his wife because he had excelled at football. The final group included 1 African-American man, 1 Hispanic man, 2 white women, and 8 African-American women. On the whole, Marcia Clark was pleased, especially the alternates. She and Bill Hodgman didn't even exercise all 20 of their preliminary challenges. Like, the fuck?
Right?
She did not listen. She did not Mm-mm. listen well. Mm-mm. Donald Vinson was like, this is what you need. And she was like, I'm going to do my own thing. I know more than you.
Right? And look where that got her.
She was very wrong. This case is kind of a big case when we talk about the defense strategy. It's really hard to talk about this case without talking about race. It just is. And it's something that Tara and I have thought about over the years when it's come to this case, and probably has why we've waited some time to do it. But the race card is a term used very often in this case. Bob Shapiro came out early, basically spinning that OJ didn't kill Nicole and Ron, but the LAPD were having a cover up and they were using OJ Simpson as an scapegoat just because he was black. Which if that was true, that's a horrific thing.
Yeah.
It's terrifying because there are places in this country that happens.
Yep.
This is not one of those cases.
Right.
I mean, O.J. Simpson was literally the most celebrity endorser of the LAPD. They could come to his house and host pool parties. Every year at Christmas time, O.J. Simpson went to their holiday parties and they just basically be like, O.J., want to come? And he's like, I'm right here. Mm-hmm. He's the most LAPD celebrity that there ever was up until the time of June 12, 1994. So why would the LAPD frame their biggest celebrity ally? And why the fuck did Marcia Clark not ask that question?
Right.
Because she's not good at her job. Okay, so I found this like curriculum that this man by the name of Peter Herndon wrote, and it is from the Yale New Haven Teachers Institute, and it's literally a synopsis written for this class, and the class is called Playing the Race Card, Two Famous Trials. So there's like this OJ case and there's another one. But this is the excerpt taken from that curriculum. It says, racial undertones were established right from the beginning of this case. A black man was accused of killing his white ex-wife and her white male friend. The lead detective in the case, Mark Furman, was clearly a bigot and hated persons of African-American descent. Robert Shapiro, one of Simpson's attorneys, said that Simpson's legal team chose to play the race card, adding that we dealt it from the bottom of the deck. This is not a very pretty statement, but an effective one. One of all the hundreds of witnesses that paraded the stand, the Simpson case, Mark Furman and his use of the N-word was the prosecution's gift to the defense that may have turned the tide decisively in Simpson's favor. Despite the mountain of evidence prepared by the prosecution that included DNA evidence, the 911 audio tapes from Nicole and a bloody glove, a jury quietly concluded that the prosecution had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that O.J. Simpson was guilty of these horrific crimes. One masterful stroke employed by the defense to agree that O.J. Simpson try-on is, in quotes, the glove for the jury and the whole world to see what better way to reinforce their twin theory of sloppy police work and the police conspiracy to finger Simpson. Johnny Cochran's rhyming couplet, after O.J. struggled to put on the glove, rang true to the jury. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And acquit they did, much to the anger of some and the cheers of others. Before we went on any further, I just thought, like, finding an academic source that talked about the race card, because I'm sensitive to the fact that as a white woman, I don't have the voice to talk about it in a way that's like my own story.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that being raised with a black brother and watching his life and always worrying about him, I understand that there are places in this world that he's not safe.
Yeah.
But O.J. Simpson in Brentwood, California was safe. And when we take away the true travesty of, like, what happened to Rodney King and basically, like, make O.J. Simpson the biggest martyr there is, in my opinion, it's just, it took away what actually happened to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so O.J. Simpson, his attorneys, there was some inner fighting. Basically, Robert Shapiro was the lead defense attorney on this case because he was hired first. And then when Cochran was brought in, it just quickly became evident to everyone else that Robert Shapiro just was not cut out for this position. And I was like, I don't know why Robert Shapiro is like throwing a big fit. But come to find out, the reason why he didn't want to step down as lead or lead defense attorney is if he had stayed on as the lead defense attorney, O.J. Simpson would have had to pay him $1.2 million.
Whoa.
However, if he became like second chair, he would only get $700,000. That's what, $500,000, mm-hmm, that he was like, I want that. So, and when the whole sniping began, because basically F. Lee Bailey went on Larry King and was like, he's not good at his job. And then he just kept having blunders. Basically, Robert Shapiro from like the fucking get, literally, like, he's been hired to be O.J. Simpson's lawyer. The Saturday after, or like the not, maybe not that Saturday, but the Saturday after, he literally holds court with like all of these like super fancy white attorneys. He basically asks them all who thinks he did it. Everyone just kind of chuckles about it. But he basically like picks their brain of what they need. He had no idea. And throughout the whole trial, Shapiro tries to get Simpson to cop a plea bargain. He even comes up with this, like, he like spends what the what the prosecution is saying, that basically like OJ went over there and found him and Nicole together and he was enraged and he killed him and we could get manslaughter. And literally he suggests this and OJ just kind of is like, okay, so Johnny, what do you have? Like, literally just like ignores him. And so Shapiro and Cochran fight. And this basically comes down right down to opening statements.
Mm-hmm.
Shapiro is like, I'm the fucking lead defense attorney. I need to give this. And Simpson basically was like, no, we're going to let Johnny do it.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's a given.
I'm going to tell you the truth, guys. I'm going to show Tara this document right now. I want your, this is what I was like having problems. It is the transcript from the day in which they give their opening statements is 83 pages long.
Yeah.
And mainly it's because throughout his opening statement, Johnny Cochran actually starts to like argue instead of just lay out the case. Like, he's like arguing the case in his opening statement. So Bill Hodgman and Marcia Clark are like, excuse me. No, that's not, this is not time right now, guys. But some highlights of things that he says. One of the things he says is, this case is about a rush to judgment, an obvious win at any cost, is what he told the jury. He lays out the timeline and their perception, their perspective. He also like kind of dropped like some other weird shit in there as well. Like, you remember how like when we did the Casey Anthony case? What's his name? Jose Barra was like,
Baez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he was like, oh, there's a sexual assault happened and never talks about it again. Johnny Cochran does the same thing. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you guys. I'm not even going to read most of it to you. Just know that it's basically saying that there's like, he at one point he drops his whole notion that this other woman saw like four Hispanic men like at her condo and we're leaving about 10:45 and that this woman sees them. It's this whole big thing. Like, it's a lot. So before we get into the defense and denying the evidence, we should talk about the judge. So basically, way back when in July, when O.J. Simpson is arraigned, he just says the absolutely 100% not guilty. And he says this to a judge by the name of Cecil Mills. And Judge Mills was like, okay, we're going to assign this case to the Superior Court and we're going to one Mr. Judge Lance Ito. Lance Ito was used to high pressure situations. In fact, his parents met in an internment camp in World War II.
Oh.
Like, you know, when the U.S. like rounded a people up Asian heritages up and put them in camps. That's where they met.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did his undergraduate at UCLA, which seems to be a theme in this case. And he got his degree from UC Berkeley. He seemed to really like the UC system. And he would graduate in 1975. He would join the LA's district attorney office in 1977. In 1981, he would marry Margaret York. And she was the first woman to obtain the rank of deputy chief of the LAPD and was the department's highest ranking officer when she retired in 2002. He was appointed to the state Supreme Court in 1989. And in 1992, he handled the indictment against Lyle and Eric Menendez. You know, the people who keep popping up in this case. Mm-hmm. He was a huge celebrity follower. He was like enamored with them. In fact, at one point in time, he told a journalist that he was really excited because Arsenio Hall had sent him an autograph.
Hmm.
So because he was married to a prominent member of the LAPD, Mills offered the defense a chance to argue to get Ito excused, but they were like, whatever. They knew that he was into this like celebrity gravitas situation. So they were like, no, we want him. And interestingly enough, when Ito was in the DA's office, one Mr. Johnny Cochran was his boss.
What? Yeah. Like, I didn't know, but.
So we know all of the players at this point.
Yes.
So the defense team had to establish a reasonable doubt so that they could get an acquittal. They're basically, to summarize really short into three words, it is compromised, contaminated, and corrupted. They use this over and over again in the opening statement. If you want to read it, it's online. I'm not going to read it to you like I mentioned earlier because it took them hours. They argued that the DNA evidence that was found at Simpson's was compromised and was mishandled by a criminologist by the name of Dennis Fung. Fung is weird. He literally was like on the stand for like 9 days. And when he left, he like shook all of the attorney's hands, including O.J. Simpson's hand, like that the fucker wasn't on trial for murder and he wasn't just the guy up there getting grilled about his sloppy work. It was crazy. Like, there was even this like one point where like they were like Sheck, who was the guy who like argued all of the evidence, the DNA evidence and stuff. There is this like moment where there's a smudge on the back gate that they basically took a sample from like several days later, like a long time later, actually. And it was a big deal because they're saying that that smudge wasn't there, that it was planted. And they were trying to say, and I'm going to find this, that there was something on it called, oh, I can't say this word. I am so sorry, guys. I'm going to try real hard. Ethyl diamitrachic acid, or as known as EDTA. And they were like, oh, that's what's in to preserve the blood and everything like that. But fun fact, it's also found in a Big Mac.
Oh.
Yeah. So like, where did Cato and Simpson go earlier that night?
McDonald's.
Interesting.
They got Big Macs. They said it.
Interestingly enough, they basically were trying to insinuate that like they did plant the evidence at the gate and that it wasn't there prior because it was collected on July 3rd versus June 13th. And they were like, well, how could it be less corrupted? And basically what they were saying is because of the climate of Brentwood, the area it was actually like in a great climate just to exist versus like other contaminated samples that have been like touched with things. One of the key things that the prosecution brought up was the blood splatter on the socks. And basically, they were saying that you know, that the LAPD poured blood over the socks because police nurse who took the blood testified in the preliminary trial that he had taken 8 milliliters of blood, like the little vials, but they only could account for like 6.5 milliliters. And they were like, oh, those 2 milliliters were like used to like frame OJ Simpson. And then basically at the trial, the nurse was like, I just said 8 because that's what I thought it was. But like, there's a good chance it was 6.5. Because we don't really pay that close attention. We just take enough blood that we think. Interesting. If you are a patron, we're going to talk about the blood splatter when we talk about a documentary. I'm spoiling it for the patrons right now. But
Yeah. I'm excited for that.
Me too. And then they basically said that like Van Adder was the one who basically did this. And at the end, Johnny Cochran had to have this like chart made up. And he called it the Big Fat Lies of Van Adder. So yeah, it was pretty, it was a lot. Every piece of evidence that the prosecution put up, the defense just was like, it's not real. It was contaminated. It was a cover up. It was a cover up. It was a cover up. In fact, Johnny Cochran says that like 17 times in his closing statement. Now we talk about the most critical piece of evidence that basically fucked everything up for the prosecution. Mm-hmm. And the defense was like, aha. The prosecution had called Richard Rubin, and he basically was an expert in these gloves, the Aries gloves. And he came and he like talked about them. And these particular Aries lights were only sold in Bloomingdale's. And there were only 300 extra large Aries lights in brown sold at Bloomingdale's. And wouldn't you fucking know, when they went and looked at Nicole Brown Simpson's credit card statements, they're literally, she bought 2 pairs. And the prosecution is like, aha! Mm-hmm. There were photos of him. They're literally photos of him wearing it. And interesting that I didn't know, but was in the book, which I thought was interesting, is these, everyone was like, the gloves are really tight on OJ. And yes, he stopped taking his arthritis medicine, so his like knuckles and stuff. But these gloves were actually meant to be worn really snug. They were meant to basically be like, gotcha, a second skin. Men's gloves were typically really bulky, and these were meant to be a little bit designed more like women's gloves, to be a little thinner and a little more dainty. And that's why they were called the Aries Lights. And OJ Simpson exclusively wore these gloves from 1990 when Nicole purchased them to 1994.
Yep.
Those were his gloves of choice. He only wore them. Like, basically, they should have been giving him a deal that they would have immediately regretted later. The prosecution got together and they talked about like whether or not they should put the gloves on OJ Simpson. And they decided that because of the state of the gloves, like they had been soaked in blood, which I Googled it. Gloves, leather gloves soaked in blood can shrink because it's a liquid. They also had been manhandled and mistreated, and they were a piece of evidence. And because they were a piece of evidence, they'd cut pieces out. So the integrity of the gloves were not the same. Bailey tried to do like a little sneaky thing in the prosecution. I don't know if we talked about this last time. Basically, like, he took a plastic bag, like evidence bag, and he put a glove in it and then like put it in a sock and like was like, couldn't Furman have done this? Like, and Marcia Clark was like, okay, no. And they were like, well, the size was small. Even Ito was like, that's not even the right size glove. And Marcia Clark made like a joke. She's like, oh, those must be Bailey's gloves. Basically, in court, on record.
Oh, shit.
Insinuating that F. Lee Bailey had a small penis.
Okay, that's funny.
And he took offense to that, and he was like, those are not my gloves. So basically, right before the glove evidence, they had been, the prosecution, because the prosecution brought this up, they had been showing, like, all of the, like, horrific autopsy photos for, like, 9 straight days. And then the glove guy comes in, and it's kind of like almost humorous to the defense team at this point. Like, the day before, they're staring at this gaping neck wound. And then today, this dude is up here talking about gloves. And, you know, they adjourn they like go on recess for lunch. And the defense team is actually playing with the gloves. Like, cause they're going up and they're looking at it, and they're like holding them and looking at them. And like, you know, Bob Shapiro puts it up to his hand, and the gloves like barely fit him. But OJ, like, they'd been seeing him through the plexiglass for so long that when he would, like, put his hand up, they would put their hand up. And they were like, his hand is big. Like, in one of the books I was reading, I don't remember if it was this one or one of the other ones, they were described his hands. Mm-hmm. And this dude was like, OJ Simpson's hands were basically, like, bigger than my head.
Oh, whoa.
Like, this dude was like, OJ Simpson could have grabbed my head with his hand. The defense is like, okay, we can't get him to do it. We have to get the prosecution. So, F. Lee Bailey, love to fucking rattle Chris Darden, just like Johnny Cochran did. And he walked up to this man and leaned into his ear and said, "You have the balls of a stud field mouse. If you don't have OJ try them on, I will."
What?
So tiny balls. You have tiny balls there.
Oh my God.
I was like, oh my God, Bailey, you cut the quick. Like, Jesus. So Chris Darden is like, fuck, I have big balls. I have big balls.
Jesus Christ.
That's basically what it was. He was like, I will. And so he goes against his team and OJ Simpson gets full control of this demonstration. Mind you, the other reason they didn't want to do this is they knew the gloves were tight. They knew they had been like Marsha Clark is like, they're smaller now than they should be. And they have to put fucking latex gloves on this because the fucking gloves themselves are biohazards. They're soaked in blood. So this is on page 367. It says, Darden walked over to Simpson and said, "I'm handing Mr. Simpson the left glove, Rockingham." This was wrong. The left glove came from Bundy and the right from Rockingham. So already just Chris Darden striking the fuck out. Darden asked Simpson to walk towards him and the jury, and both Cochran and one of the sheriff's deputies came with the defendant, creating a traffic jam in front of the jury box. As Simpson walked, he began trying to put on the left glove. All the time, Simpson kept his thumb bent outward at a right angle to his wrist. So like, boom.
Mm-hmm. Like flexed, yeah.
That too made it impossible for the glove to fit properly. OJ grimaced and said, more or less to Cochran, but really to the jury, "Too tight." "Your Honor," Darden said, in his voice now trembling. Apparently, Mr. Simpson seems to be having a problem putting the glove on his hand. Johnny Cochran, stifling a smile, properly objects to Darden's narrative of the event. Basically, they have the glove guy look at it, and Darden sees what's going on. He's like, "Can you have him straighten his finger?" Darden's ass. "Can you ask him to straighten his fingers and extend them into the glove as one normally might put the glove on?" Ito said yes, and Cochran burst out again. "Your Honor, object to this statement by counsel." Like, what the fuck? You're just being like... Then Darden asked if would go on to ask him to, like, grab a marker and, like... So fucking dumb of him. So, like, to hold it. OJ Simpson understood the assignment here. Like, he knew, like, I can't grab this like I would a fucking knife.
I'm pretty sure this part's on, like, you can see it on YouTube and stuff.
Yeah, it says it was held in his hand the way a baby would hold a marker.
Jesus. Oh, God.
And I guess his, like, thumb was, like, out or something like that. And then Darden was like, "Can you, simulate stabbing someone?" And so OJ was just like, meh, just, you know, fake stabbing the air with a marker.
Oh my God.
And basically this just made Darden look like an idiot. And the only thing that kind of saved him in this, but didn't actually save him at all, was that Darden was like, asked Richard Rubin, who was the glove expert, to be like, "Do you think these gloves fit OJ?" And he said, yes, at one time they fit him. At the end of all of this, at the end of the day, Marsha Clark would say, "Do you think it's all over now?"
Oh my God.
Now we get into another interesting part of this case. Mm-hmm. Mark Furman.
Yeah.
Because the OJ Simpson trial quickly became the Mark Furman trial. If you remember the prosecution, he was a key witness because he found the evidence at Bundy. Or not at Bundy, at Rockingham.
Yeah, the glove.
Mm-hmm. Right, mind you, he was lead detective for all of like an hour. Because then Van Atter and Lang came in and took over.
Gotcha.
The prosecution wanted Furman to talk about finding the glove because then they could bring it into evidence. However, they could have done that through Van Atter. They could have talked about him going and getting it, everything like that. In the preliminary trial, Chris Darden asks Judge Ito to ban the N-word from the court, and it does not go his way. Basically, they're like, no, no, no. And he said it, I quote, "It's a dirty, filthy word," Darden said. "It's not a word that I allow people to use in my household, and I'm sure Mr. Cochran doesn't. And the reason we don't is because it is an extremely derogatory and degrading word because of its prejudicial and also extremely inflammatory, that the use of the word in any situation will invoke some type of emotional response from any African-American within earshot." And then Johnny Cochran jumps up and is like, basically like, oh, you're saying that Black people can't handle hearing the N-word because they're too emotional, and basically like hands him, and he also says, "my good friend," which we know that Cochran was like, bullshit. when he wins, when Cochran wins this move, he leans over to Darden and says, "Inward, please." Johnny Cochran has huge balls. I was like, Johnny Cochran, Jesus. So when the prosecution is done and the defense cross-examines Furman, they do that. And F. Lee Bailey gets up and point blank asked him, "Have you ever in the last 10 years used the N-word?" And he's like, "No." And he asks it several different ways. And at one point, Furman says, "Not that I can recall." And he goes, "Oh, so you just said it and you can't recall it?" He's like, "No, it's the way you asked the question." And I was like, "Oh, Furman, we're snapping back." Yeah, he fucker should not have. Fucker should have just owned up to his shit. Because Mark Furman
is a piece of
not only has used the N-word, but he used it 41 times span of 12 hours.
Piece of shit.
Super piece of shit. So basically what ends up happening is, if you remember when we did the recap of the new Casey Anthony thing, mm-hmm. wherever it was on, mm-hmm. I think it was on
Paramount, something. Yeah.
Something. We don't know. We watched it one time. We never do it again. She's working for a private investigator by the name of Pat McKenna. And when I'm listening, because I was listening to this book and reading it in person, they're talking about Pat McKenna throughout this case. And I was like, where the fuck do I know Pat mm-hmm. McKenna from? And I'm texting Tara and I was like, I even asked you, like, I don't know who Pat McKenna is. And you're like, I don't know. The name sounds familiar, though. And I Googled him. He's the fucking person that Casey Anthony works for. Like, currently.
Uh-huh. Yup. And if you watch that, you know he's on it. How her and OJ met.
OJ Simpson and Pat McKenna, or and Casey Anthony, are friends because they have a person in common, Pat McKenna. I have been for years being like, how the fuck did they find each other?
True. Oh my God. Yeah, true.
And literally, if you guys have followed like the Sarah Turney thing, she literally just put out a TikTok yesterday, mm-hmm. in real time, mm-hmm. where she was talking about her dad should join an acquittal club. Literally moments before Tara saw that, she texted me that. We were talking about it. And then she sent me that. She's like, oh my God, this is crazy. This case, the OJ Simpson case, has literally rocked our whole world.
Yeah,
It's too much, guys. It's too much.
It's okay. We're getting there.
Yeah, we're almost done, guys. I promise. So Pat McKenna is the private investigator that F. Lee Bailey like brings out. And Shapiro has his own people, but they're not very good. And literally he comes up with like every time he sees Shapiro, he comes up with like bizarro like conspiracy theories. McKenna is like doing the phone lines one night, and this dude named Brian calls and is like, hey, so there's this chick named Laura Hart McKinney, and she's a screenwriter, and she basically has audio recording of Furman using the N-word.
Right.
And they were like, oh my God, this is the deal. This was such a big deal in this case that literally they asked Ito for like to recess. Shapiro and Bailey fucking went to North Carolina, which is where the tapes mm-hmm. were, like, was her home state, mm-hmm. where she had like done everything.
Where they're at, yeah.
Well, because she lived in like Santa Monica or
Santa Barbara
or someplace like that. Something to do with like her home state and like where the tapes were, I think, maybe residing. I don't know.
Interesting.
But basically, they go and they have to win this court case to be able to get the tapes. They had read the transcripts and the transcripts were terrible. Johnny Cochran was like, this is terrible. And basically, because Johnny Cochran went in and was like, I'm swagger, the judge was like, no. And they had to like appeal it, and Bailey had to appeal it because, you know, he understands the men of the South, apparently.
Gotcha.
So they get this. Essentially what it is that Laura Hart McKinney was a screenwriter and she was wanting to write a screenplay about a woman in the police force. And she just happened to meet Mark Furman. They were both single in their 30s. They were like, hey, friend, let's talk. They were flirting, blah, blah, blah. Basically, Furman is like the trashiest person. He basically tells them that he's part of the LAPD, but also he's part of this like super elite, like underground club called MAO, which is Men Against Women, because they did not believe that women should be police officers.
Wow.
Ugh, it's terrible. Like, all of the shit he even talks about. So at one point in time, there could have been a mistrial for this reason alone. So Margaret Peggy York is the wife of Judge Lance Ito. She was, in fact, Furman's superior officer at one point in time, which wasn't that big of a deal. However, he said that she sucked and fucked her way to the top on tape.
What the fuck?
So Lance Ito had to be like, I'm just going to say this. Like, I'm super paraphrasing. He was like, that's fucked up. Like, he should not have talked about my wife.
Yeah.
And they could have, like, they could have removed him. But neither side wanted to remove him because they had gotten the jury down. The defense had gotten the jury where they wanted it. There was, like, one problem person. And then the defense or the prosecution was like, we can't fucking do this again. If we redo this again, it's going to be a nightmare. Which, I mean, like, if you do it again, you could just, like, go back in and be like, okay, we're going to get the N-word, like, removed because look at the controversy. They played those tapes, not for the jury, but they played the tapes for the public. Everyone in the country mm-hmm. slash, yeah, everyone heard it except for the jurors. The jurors were only allowed on, so on September 5th of 1995, they were only allowed to hear two lines in which Furman used the N-word. He said there are no N-word where I grow up, and he said people don't want N-word in their town, people don't want Mexicans in their town. And I feel like Ito was like, what is the least controversial way he used this word? And he found two lines that was super not controversial, and that fucking says so much.
Yeah,
he literally talks about in the book he literally fucking talks about like how these like guys had like shot a cop and they like busted into this apartment and they like held this woman at gunpoint saying they were gonna blow her head off, and they got these guys and they basically beat the fuck out of them and like, you know, using the N-word up and up and up, and like basically it was like this whole thing to the point where like he's bragging about how he broke their faces, how like one dude had to get like 70 stitches on their head, that they went back out and like out back and basically washed their hands and face and badges off and then went out and directed traffic like nothing had happened.
What the fuck?
And that had like an internal investigation of like 300 and something pages. And he was like bragging to her that he had like 4,000 pages worth of internal investigations related to race issues. Because if you remember, I don't know if we actually talked about this, but Mark Furman literally tried to sue the LAPD saying that the LAPD made him racist and that he wanted to go on disability because they made him racist. Fucking read this book. It's amazing. My God. Like, you're going to learn.
Please, like,
it's crazy. Yeah, this is
I need to buy that. Good idea.
So then they bring Furman, the defense, they bring Furman back in and they ask him, did you say this? They basically were like asking him questions and he kept pleading the fifth. And so when they ask him, did you mishandle? He pled the fifth. So right there, the fucking gift wrap of reasonable doubt was handed to the jury. At the end of all of that crazy shenanigans, Cochran gets up one last time. It's him and Sheck get up, and like Sheck goes through all of like the DNA shit. But Cochran basically talks about how this is the LAPD's Furman, Lang, and Van Adder basically targeted O.J. Simpson. That Furman, who obviously didn't like black people, you know, it's very obvious if you ever, like, I don't recommend listening to them or hearing them. They're terrible. It's gut-wrenchingly gross what Furman did. And people were saying like that he only did it because he was playing a character, but it was just too free-flowing.
Bullshit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cochran would compare Furman to Adolf Hitler, and he would call him a genocidal racist, America's worst nightmare, and personification of evil. What the defense did is they were like, hey, don't look at the fact that this man slaughtered two people. Look at the fact that there's this racist dude involved. And Marcia Clark basically had to get up and be like, we hate him too. But that's not what this is about. And she did an okay job, but she didn't do a good enough job.
Right, exactly.
So with that, the jury goes out to deliberate. And it was literally, and at this point in time, like Gil Garcetti is like preparing for like war. Bill Clinton is also like, hey, what are the, like, what do you need security wise? They have cops on horses. They have everything barricaded because if he is found guilty, they think there's going to be another riot like in 92.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after summations, the closing statements are made, everything like that. All the fucking lawyers take off. OJ goes back to jail. Everyone else leaves. And then they all get called back because there was only literally, it was 4 hours. They deliberated for 4 hours. Yeah, it was so fast. Literally 4 hours. It was obviously, if you've paid attention, he was acquitted because in Johnny Cochran's closing statement, he said, if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. And the jurors took him literally and figuratively, and they basically acquitted him of the murders, and the two families that were sitting there had to watch it. Kim Goldman literally shrieked out crying.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's terrible.
Oh
yeah. So we done with this episode.
Okay. Jessica's talked a long, long time. She is done.
I'm so proud of myself.
So proud of you. So proud of you.
We do have one more episode
of OJ stuff. Yes. So there won't be a listeners or maybe is this, I don't even see that's the thing. I don't even know at this point what's going up when. So I'm like, oh shit.
This would be listeners episode.
Okay. So yes, we just skipped listeners this month because of this massive series.
Yeah.
But it will be back next. It will be back for October. So don't worry. Lots of cool stuff. But anyways, with that, we are going to go ahead and wrap it up for today. Thank you guys for listening, as always. And again, come hang out with us on social media. And if you have a suggestion for us to do another really deep dive like this, please let us know, because I know we both have really enjoyed investing this much.
We have. I have done nothing else but talk about O.J. Simpson. I think people in my life are annoyed with me because I'll be like, random fact, O.J. Simpson, blah, blah, blah. And they're like,
yup, same.
Stop it.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up and we'll see you next time. Bye, guys.
Toodles.